Well, our next guest on the program is the author of 9 previous books and the brand new one that we're going to talk about today called The League. He's also a former sports writer for the Baltimore Sun, has covered the Ravens and more, and he's written a wonderful book about one of the key points in the history of the National Football League. It's called The League, How 5 Rivals Created the NFL and Launched a Sports Empire. John Eisenberg joins us. John, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
I love the book so much. What to me is so fascinating about it is there are people that we know as legends of this league. The Halluses, the Maras, Marshall, Burt Bell, Art Rooney. And yet this book talks about a time when they were far from being legends. And some of them had some fairly inauspicious beginnings.
Yes, that was my goal with the sort of these guys. They're all now where we sit now, they're all lions of the game, right? I mean, they're all in the Hall of Fame and they're considered founding fathers. But my goal for this book was to depict them in real time as they were in the early days of the NFL when the league was struggling terribly and was really a third-rate failing enterprise in many respects and franchises folded. And these guys came along and started teams. And they tried to beat each other on the field, but off the field, they realized they had to work together as in the business of pro football. And they had many, many obstacles. George Halas didn't have much money, and just one thing after the other. They went through the stock market crash, the Depression, World War II, and many, many challenges really took pro football to the brink, hard as that is to believe. But these were the guys that carried it through.
And really, Burt Bell, among that key group, was the only guy that came from a somewhat privileged upbringing. The rest of them had certainly struggled. A couple of them were making their money primarily as bookmakers.
Yes, these were not. Today's NFL owners are titans of industry, right? These guys were not titans of industry. They were in many respects, they were sons of immigrants. In some respects, it's really the story of 20th century America. These were sons of immigrants with an idea. That's really all they had. And, it's entrepreneurship, so much of which we saw in the 20th century. And these guys, no one was going to swoop in and save them. Burt Bell, as you said, it was born on Main Line, raised Main Line, Philadelphia. Now, he did have a lot of money. He blew it all at the betting window. Tim Mara was a legal bookmaker. That's what he did. He took bets on the horse races, and Art Rooney never worked a day in his life. He was a gambler, period. You can't do this anymore, or maybe you can, I don't know. But, I mean, he made his money at the racetrack. When he needed money, he went to the track, and he was a great horse racing handicapper. So certainly not titans of industry.
Well, we love reading about Burt Bell. His son Upton is a great friend of the show, and actually is the one who recommended your book, and I'm glad he did because it's terrific. But he's such a fascinating character in this because of the family connections, and his father had experience in the organization of leagues as really one of the founding members of the NCAA.
Yes, Burt Bell came from a college football background. There's no doubt he played at Penn. He coached at Penn. He coached at Temple. And his father, yes, was one of the founders, pretty much. He was a rules expert, a college football aficionado, sneered at pro football. And he was not alone in the people that sneered at pro football in the 20s and the 30s. College football was much more popular. Football in that era was deemed, its place in society was really as a character-building exercise for young men. You really go back to the roots of the game. That's what people saw it as. And so high school football, college football were very popular. But professional football, it was considered like unseemly to pay someone to play football. So that is what Burt had to fight. His father believed that until he went to his grave. And so, yes, Burt, ultimately, it's highly ironic that he ultimately became a pro football guy.
We're talking with John Eisenberg on Downtown about his terrific new book, The League, fascinating with the Patriots in many ways owning the Boston sports landscape, even with a World Series champion in the Boston Red Sox. But it's amazing to look back in your book and realize that local sports writers let George Preston Marshall know that pro football had absolutely no future in Boston.
Yes, Boston's role in this is something. There'd been a team in I think, 1 year, 1929, and it lasted 1 year, was gone. And then George Preston Marshall comes along. He's from Washington, D.C. He's fairly wealthy from the laundry business, and he wanted to put a team in Washington. And the NFL, Joe Carr, was the first president of the NFL, and Halas and these guys, they all told him, nope, we're not abandoning Boston. We want to have a team in Boston. He really didn't want to go. And so, but he did, and it did not work. The Redskins were in Boston. As many of your listeners may know, I don't know, maybe they don't, but they had 5 years there that were not successful, certainly off the field. He didn't get along with the sports writers. The fans didn't come. They just didn't buy it at all. And so George Preston Marshall abandoned Boston and went to Washington, and the Redskins were an enormous success almost immediately in Washington. And the Boston market sort of flopped around for, there were a few more franchises that came in. It really wasn't until the Patriots came along that it sort of tightened up and became more of a pro football market. It really was a failure for many, many years.
Marshall never embraced a lot of the societal changes. Part of that, as you point out in the book, is because of where he was in Washington in relation to the Mason-Dixon line. But many people aren't aware or forget that the National Football League broke the color barrier in professional sports a year before Jackie Robinson. Why doesn't the NFL get more credit for that?
That's a really good question. The NFL had African-American players in the 20s and the early 30s. Then Marshall comes into the league, and he's a son of Confederate officers and was very clear where he stood, and he becomes a person of influence in the league very quickly, and these other men followed his lead, I'm quite sure. So through 1945, it was all white, the NFL, not a proud period in that league's history, and they integrated or reintegrated only because the Rams moved from Cleveland to L.A., and we're going to play in the publicly funded Coliseum, and a black sports writer there stood up and said, you cannot have a segregated league playing games in this publicly funded stadium. Mm. So the league reintegrated in 1946 with the Rams, and there were Kenny Washington was a receiver, and he had played with Jackie Robinson at UCLA and knew Jackie. And he was sort of at the end of his game there, wasn't as good. But I don't know, the NFL, it just wasn't. They'd had players before African-Americans, and it just didn't have the drama. Washington was sort of near the end of his career. And also there was a rival league, the All-American Football Conference. The Cleveland Browns started up that year, 1946. They also had African-American players, great ones, Marion Motley. So it wasn't just the NFL that integrated at that time. So it's just a little bit less. I mean, it's great that they did it. It just is a little bit less to celebrate, I think, than what happened in baseball.
Well, the whole thing might have run aground if the league, with the help of Bert Bell, had not found a way to avert a potentially huge scandal before the 1946 championship game. This is such a great story.
Completely lost in the midst of history, and I consider myself a pro football expert, and this was new to me. And that on the eve of the championship game, the Giants, there was a gambling scandal. The quarterback and the fullback of the Giants had consorted with a gambler. The gambler had offered them bribes to throw the game. And the 1946 championship game against the Bears in the Polo Grounds in New York. And so word got out, I believe it was a security detail, had heard about it, a security detail attached to the Giants had heard about it. And so the scandal breaks like the night before the game, in the middle of the night practically. It's like, these guys aren't going to play. And Bert Bell just stepped in the middle of it. He had just become commissioner. And Bert Bell is just a huge person of influence in the history of this league. He had an unbelievable instinct for knowing what was really important in pro football. He'd invented the draft 10 years earlier before he became commissioner. And he just understood that this game, the Black Sox scandal almost brought baseball down. This could really bring football down. And so in the wake of that scandal, all sorts of Bert Bell just led the charge. All sorts of of rules were put in to keep the injury reports that we see three times a week
right.
put in, because that's why gamblers were in locker rooms. They wanted to know who was hurt. They could beat the point spread. So everything became transparent at 1946, and it was Burt Bell's doing.
Also, very interesting to note that George Halas, in many ways, saw the future, although at first he wasn't impressed when he looked at the little black box that was TV in those early days, but he was also one of the first to maybe realize the potential of football on television.
Yes, I did a chapter near the end of the book about TV's history in football, its role in football's rise, pro football's rise. Is just, you can't state it enough. I write about the years from 1920 to the late 40s. When the league was struggling, there just wasn't much money on the table. It was either tickets, a little bit of radio revenue, and they just didn't have much money. They were just getting by. When TV came in, and it took a while for them to figure out how to use it, and they were worried that if they started giving their games away for free, no one would come. They had all these issues. But Halas was the one that, and other ones figured it out. If you broadcast games, maybe in other cities, you could develop fans. This was before there were national TV contracts. And so Halas, suddenly, by the early 50s to mid-50s, the Bears games are being shown in 70 markets, cities around the country. They would take the feed. And so suddenly he was making a lot of money. For the first time, people were really making money in pro football. And, of course, they've been making money ever since.
Yeah, they've come a long way from the group that started, as George Halas said, on the running board of a Hupmobile. Would the league have survived without these five guys who were extremely competitive but also saw the big picture and realized that they couldn't have individual success if they weren't all successful?
Well, that's a great question, and I'm not sure it would have. There were key periods. The appetite for pro football was just not strong in the United States. It was probably the fifth sport in America. Baseball was a national pastime. College football was very popular. Horse racing was very popular. Boxing. Those were really, really popular sports. Pro football, people, as I said before, they didn't care to watch football as much, where people were being paid to play it. So there was not much appetite. And it took these guys just believing in their product and continually tinkering and working on the game, improving it, eventually separating it from the college game, making it different. The draft, of course, was a huge thing. Another one that they did, they invented George Preston Marshall. There was no postseason in pro football.
Right.
Until the first 13 years, this whoever had the best record was the champ. And Marshall, he came from the theater, and he said, let's get some drama in here. Let's split these teams up into two divisions and have the winners play. So a championship game like the World Series. So moves like that, I mean, they just were brilliant men. And they made mistakes, many of them, but when you put them together, what their collective energies and instincts were, it was very formidable, and I'm not sure this league would have survived without these guys.
John, I have to sidetrack to present-day football for just a moment, because you write about the Baltimore Ravens. What do you think of our former Maine Black Bear, Project Pat, with the Ravens, Pat Ricard?
Oh, tremendous. Pat Ricard. Yes, I'm a columnist on the Ravens digital channels, and I see every game, and Pat is just a huge success story, and it's great. I mean, he's on both sides of the ball. They use him. There have been a couple of games this year where he's played on both sides of the ball. I mean, you see him in the defensive line, and you see him at fullback, and just a great guy. He's caught some touchdown passes, and the fans here love him. You know, Baltimore, they love blue-collar players, and Pat Ricard is the definition of that. So, he's having a great run here in Baltimore.
No question about that. Well, this book is terrific. A fascinating story about the five guys instrumental in the success, survival, and ultimately domination in many ways of the National Football League. The book is called The League. John Eisenberg, loved reading it. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on.